or a prerequisite. So, and you know, I'm pretty good at double talk, and so I tried my best, but they saw through it.
Yeah.
And so the majority of them ended up going into, you know, the principal licensure track, or they dropped out after the first year. Because right. we didn't have the actual opportunities that required getting this this additional training.
Huh. So they saw through it.
Yep. So that was a part of our own fault in not having thought that through ahead of time. Now after that 2 years, we dropped it and said this didn't work like we wanted it to work. And I think that if we recreate it, we're going to have to recreate it. I don't know whether we have to recreate it with a different institution or we have to recreate it, but we're going to have to try to recreate it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So,
aligned with the needs of younger generation.
Right. And, oh my goodness, that adds a whole new dimension.
Yes. Yes, we all know that they are more demanding and want more things out of it.
Mm-hmm. Instantly.
Yeah, instantly.
And also think that, you know, walking in the door, that they can do anything.
Yeah.
They have a lot of skills, and if they don't have skills, they think they can, you know, pick it up on the internet. and they can just go ahead and do anything. So I have three colleagues that and we go around the country doing training on the generations in the workplace.
Yeah.
About the millennials and the Gen Xers and the boomers and the traditionalists, all trying to, you know, work in the same workplace, and it doesn't work.
No. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's how you talk Minnesotan. It's interesting. That's how you talk when your Swedish relatives serve you anchovy potato casserole. It's interesting. Well, we also... You mentioned Edison School.
Yeah.
And I think you meant the Edison Corporation. Edison.
Yeah.
And I'll just slip in a few sentences about that because that was part of an interesting experiment that I had quite a bit to do with, and I've always wondered whether it should be called Sundance Folly or not. But... at the time when Edison was much more active in going around to urban school districts saying, we'll take over your schools,
right.
I thought, well, they were knocking on the door, and Minneapolis was, they were threatening that either they came into Minneapolis or they'd start charter schools. So I said to the board chair and the superintendent, well, one way we can handle this is that we can invite them to be a Minneapolis school. And if we bring them into the tent, we got some control over them.
Sure.
We can require them to do the same kind of student tests. We can require them to do the same, you know, assessments, and we can really know what's going on or not. So the superintendent and the board accepted the wisdom of that. And so we invited Edison to take over a Minneapolis school. Actually, it was a building that wasn't currently a school. Over on Lake Street, which is now eventually going to become a... I think a parking lot for the light rail system.
Oh, jeez.
It's so popular. Anyway, we wrote a very extensive memorandum of agreement with the union about how the adults in the building, who they'd be, what kind of professionals they'd be, because at that time Edison wanted them all to be, you know, like in the first 4 years of teaching, so they'd be cheap. How many paraprofessionals there'd be, and all that kind of stuff. So he wrote the whose evaluation system would be used. So we had, so they couldn't just kick our folks out on a whim. So we did this extensive memorandum of agreement with the union, and then the district did an extensive memorandum of agreement with them on the governance and the facilities and all that kind of stuff. So we all did that, and they became a Minneapolis school. And the long and the short of it is that I think they were there for maybe 3 years. And for all three of those years, they were either the bottom or the second to the bottom in achievement in the district.
Jeez.
And so finally, Dr. Carol Johnson said, you know, we can't afford to have kids, you know, at the bottom, and you're not improving any. So I don't care what your sales pitch is, you're out of here. And so they did, I think, change to a charter school, but I think it's a very small one.
Right.
And so essentially, our goal in the beginning worked.
Yeah.
Because had they not been a part of the system, and had not, you know, had to take the same tests and do the same as the rest of the schools, we never would have known whether they were really, kids were really succeeding or not, because otherwise you just have to buy their PR.
Uh-huh.
And their PR can make anything sound wonderful. The other thing that they did, I think as poorly as I have ever seen done, was choose leaders. The people that they chose as administrators were, I think they went through about five in the 3 years they were there, and they were, each one was worse than the next. It was just phenomenal. So anybody who, you know, who tells us that private sector people do a better job of, you know, selecting and training leaders, pish posh. It ain't so.
Jeez.
So that was our...
That was your Edison experiment.
Our Edison experiment.
Okay. Got that out of the way.
We also had supportive legislation of much of our reform agenda. So we would, in most cases, as we did with the contract, we'd try it out first, and then we would embed it in contract and in legislation. But we had supportive legislation for, I already talked about the QComp legislation, the alternative compensation legislation, the support for staff development, site staff development committees getting the funds. The legislature requires a 2% set aside of all district funds. 2% of all the entire district budget has to go into staff development. And the requirement is that the district committee be a majority of teachers,
uh-huh,
and that the committees at the school site be a majority of teachers to spend that money. So that's an empowering thing for the profession.
And they seem to go along with this each budget cycle, that allow teachers to make that decision.
Well, mostly.
Mostly, yeah.
And then Education Minnesota did a project called the TALL Project, Teachers as Leaders and Learners, or Teachers as Learners and Leaders, I don't remember which, but that was training the teacher leaders in all of the school districts around the state. 350 school districts, training those teacher leaders on how to do that.
Hmm.
Because in a lot of those little burgs where the union, you know, doesn't have the masses to be powerful, the school district superintendent just ignored it or said, get out of here,
right,
or whatever, or use the money for something else, or to carpet his office or whatever. So Education Minnesota did a good job of training those teacher leaders around the state to do it right. We got the residency program, which is that first year, 80% teaching, 20% continuing their professional development. Got that in law. The peer review law didn't come in until 1995. We started it in 89. So in 95, then it requires the bargaining unit to negotiate with the school district for a peer review option. Site-based management and self-governed schools, we got just this last legislative session. We in this state have very good language in Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which came in 1970 with the advent of our winning our bargaining election and our strike. It was part of the strike settlement legislation for our strike. And the Teacher Tenure Act. There's two Teacher Tenure Acts in this state, one for cities of the first class and one for the rest of them. Mm-hmm. I should go back for just a second and say that in 1970, when we, as a result of our strike, there are historians and researchers who believe that that was a turning point or a tipping point of politics in the city. Up until that time, the Minneapolis was a very conservative, waspish, business-run town.
Right.
A very different, again, from St. Paul. St. Paul was more ethnic, blue-collar, but Minneapolis was known as a business town. So it was, as a matter of fact, our current superintendent, Dr. Bill Green, is going to write a book. At least he's been threatening to write a book about our strike and how it turned the politics of the city.
Huh.
Where now it's always liberal politicians, Democratic Farmer Labor Party controlled.
Right.
And that's so that very public activity sort of helped illustrate or helped push them over the edge.
Hmm. So it was a push of consciousness for those who couldn't get into power.
Right.
And were able to.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. I always, as a result of our strike, I said the Public Employee Labor Relations Act was signed in the actually signed by the president of the AFL-CIO. The deal was cut with the legislative leaders in his office, and the Public Employee Labor Relations Act is intact today, mm-hmm. as opposed to some of the rest of you who have lost yours.
Yes.
And some in the dead of night. So at every AFL-CIO convention, there's an AFSCME guy that always comes up to me and falls to his knees and kisses my rings because he's about the only one that remembers now, but he says, thank you for the Public Employee Labor Relations Act.
Nice.
Yep.
Now, all these laws that have been passed that started out in your contract,
mm-hmm.
they cover just Minneapolis or they kind
no,
of cover
the whole state? Yep.
So the whole state has peer review.
Yes.
Huh.
But it needs to be negotiated, so there are lots of districts where they don't want to touch it and don't do it and ignore it.
So it's not a requirement?
No.
Okay.
But if they do it, then they have to do it with the bargaining unit.
Gotcha. Okay, so I imagine a majority wanted to ignore it.
Well, there's quite a few that ignore it, but, legislative... There have been times that the legislature has, dangled incentives in front of school districts. They haven't done that with peer review, but they did do it with staff development 1 year or for several years on standards. And they dangled $84 per pupil for staff development. And, you know, everybody bit because they needed the money. And if you took the money, you had to do, you know, standards, development of standards, student standards. And another time was this with the performance-based pay, or the QCOMP, or the ATAPS, or whatever you want to call it, and dangling the $879 or $69 million in front of unions and school districts has worked, because there's quite a number of school districts who are experimenting with it, who are doing it. Now, out of the 350, it's probably, you know, a dozen are really doing it well, and maybe, I don't know, right. I've lost track, but maybe 20. So it's not an overwhelming majority, but a lot of them are interested, a lot of them are working on it, and a lot of them are, you know, writing proposals to see if they can get it approved.
So the two big ones are the standards and pay that AFT was pushing last decade, even almost two decades ahead.
That were incented by money at the legislature.
Right.
And then, for some of the rest of them, we garnered money through grants.
Sure.
And, you know, the federal mentor grant, the Exxon grant through the AFT for the professional practice school, the federal money through the Minnesota Department of Ed for the teacher centers, and, you know, so you're always scrambling for grants.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's one of my claims to fame that over the years I've really brought in several million dollars through grants to keep the programs going. The labor management model and philosophy that we practiced and believed in really strongly, and that I started basically back in 1986 by bringing in the Harvard group, the Getting to Yes group at Harvard, the
right.
URI group at Harvard, and doing that training and doing the refreshers four different times, the training with the pre-negotiations training that included the entire school board, the administrative team, and the entire union team. And the first one around, we also included six surrounding school districts, and we did 30 hours of training by the Harvard group and on, you know, how you work together, how you look at an issue and see what the important things are in that issue that you can work on and preserve together, to work on principled bargaining. And so they taught us that.
Mm-hmm.
Then the group was changed, the name was changed to CMI, Conflict Management Inc., for
right.
the next time around, and now it's ThoughtBridge. And now they've kind of priced themselves out of the market, so we can't afford them anymore.
So where do they go now?
Well, I don't know who's paying them, but I haven't found any school districts that can afford them.
I'm sure they can.
Now. Huh. So they must be working with somebody who's got lots of money, must be.
It's not auto.
No, it is not. So they must be working with
healthcare, probably
private sector. And we also, I think I mentioned, had the world's oldest living Panasonic partnership.
Right.
12 years. And the Panasonic partnership was always, always important, because along with the training of the leaders, they always insisted that it be the representative of the three-legged stool would be together, the union, the board, and the administration. And so when we'd go to Panasonic leadership training or Panasonic conferences, they would always emphasize that. And the Panasonic did board training, and they also were instrumental in providing researchers and consultants and to be helpful in whatever we were working on at the time. We also were one of the founding members of TURN, the Teacher Union Reform Network. And the Teacher Union Reform Network began as a group of 24 teacher unions who were from both AFT and NEA locals, who viewed themselves as most progressive unions in the country, and I'm now co-chair of the one of the co-directors of the Teacher Union Reform Network. We celebrated last year, celebrated our 10th anniversary, which most people were predicting our demise after the first year, but right. So we thought that was quite a milestone. The Teacher Union Reform Network has now expanded, and we're over 30 locals. It is a place where teacher union leaders get together, and we share ideas. We have the kinds of discussions that in some ways we used to have around the AFT Executive Council table, and where they're thoughtful discussions, they're engaging in discussions, they're active discussions about things that are difficulties, things that are possible, things that are probable futures, things that are scary futures, and we bring in writers and researchers and gurus and, you know, big names, little names, to help with that discussion. So it's a place where it's safe, it's professional development for union leaders, it's a place where you can get help, it's a place where you can get ideas, and it's a place where it's fun to be. Because there are very few places at home where a union president can actually share discussions with folks in that same role. So when you get a few miles away from home and you have other union leaders from primarily other urban locals who are facing exactly what you're facing, and you face the same political struggles, the same political dangers, and the same political, larger political issues in the community, with declining enrollment, with charter schools, with conservative politicians trying to eliminate public education altogether, with consumer parents trying to push you in one way. All of those things are issues that the majority of our TURN members experience, and so the professional development for union goons is something that we value, and we get together quarterly, and the favorite activity of the group is to hear what other people are doing and to commiserate,
right,
and to maybe offer some suggestions and say, well, we tried this and it worked, or we tried this and it didn't work, and we can help with this, or we've got language in our contract on that. And then in between time, we have a TURN list on the internet, so you can post a question to your colleagues in between time and say, I've got this issue, what have you got? And there have been several of those that have come across the TURN list just recently, from people who are either in negotiations or writing memorandums or doing something that they're looking for help or looking for contract language. So then we send them what we've got, right, and it gives them a repository of actual things that are live and working in other places. School boards and school board teams or school district teams are always more open to things if they know that it's actually going on someplace else, sure, and that they aren't inventing something. So,
what was the initial reaction from AFT and NEA on creating TURN?
Well, originally the two internationals were, I think, puzzled by TURN. And I think in some ways it depended on the people as to whether they were angry or hurt or 'cause I think that particularly the AFT thought, well, we already have the executive council meetings where discussions take place, and then we have the K-12 Program Policy Council, where, you know, they substantive discussions on substantive issues take place. So, what's the need? So then, of course, they immediately leap to personalities and the needs of personalities. But I think what they didn't understand, but they now do. Oh, they also, I think, thought that it was a threat.
A threat on the education issues department, or
no? I think they thought it was a. Actually, some thought it was a threat to membership.
Oh,
that we were going to ask locals to decertify and join TURN. So we did a lot of reassuring, and now, at least with the AFT. With this, the next generation of leaders, I think there's a pretty genuine comfort in that it's okay, and it's serves a purpose. And actually, I think there's some blessing to expand the TURN network into international TURN, which we're going to start at the next meeting, which is in June in Toronto.
Excellent.
So, and I think some realization that the more in-depth discussions are things that actually can't take place at a council meeting anymore.
Not the structure they have set up now.
No, and it's, well, for one thing, it's too big. For the second thing, you've got all five divisions there.
Yeah.
And so you have to stick with the sort of generic political stuff at those meetings, and then just have reports from the various divisions.
Yeah.
So, and the Program Policy Council, there really are so many policies now that are in jeopardy and need discussing, is that that too is it's difficult when there's 50 people sitting around that table to get a word in edgewise. So, I think that it just plays, it fills a niche, and it plays a role, and I don't think that anybody's, at least in the AFT, is threatened anymore. Some people have sort of denigrated it lately by saying, well, it's just people who want to sit around and talk, and they haven't ever done anything. But there haven't ever been any products. So I think it's all right. I think we have had products. I think there are evidences of our work in lots of subtle ways, in lots of contracts, in lots of discussions, in lots of districts that now can collaborate where they didn't before, relationships between union leaders and superintendents and boards. I think that if we were to quantify it, some might be subtle and some might be overt and some might be dramatic, but we haven't spent any time doing that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I just think the opportunity to have that professional development without the requirement to have a product is okay. So that's why we've become a self-sustaining network.
Mm-hmm.
We don't rely on grant money anymore because they always required the products. And you know that there's a need because the locals are still spending their own money to come.
It really is a therapy.
Well, yes, you could say that.
Therapy, you don't see like a real physical product.
Right.
But it feels good. You're getting better internally and externally and for everybody around you.
Right.
So it's kind of like that.
And your therapist sort of leads you through guiding questions and listens.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a good description. Now, in the NEA, something different has taken place in that the TURN locals, in the NEA TURN locals, have coalesced and become a group to be reckoned with within the NEA, and have asked for meetings with Reg and the other Reg Weaver and the other officers on a regular basis, because they have been upset that there isn't more time and attention placed in the NEA on large locals, on reform issues, on getting these, having a place where the large locals and can get together to talk about professional issues and to share. Because in the NEA, the NCUEA, the National Council of Urban Education Associations, is not a place to do that. It's a political entity, and they end up in endless discussions about what their position is going to be on endless new business items at the convention, and it's just not the place where you can have the kinds of staff to professional development and support and discussions that they want to take place.
Right.
So I think they're continuing to have those discussions, and I think that I don't really know to what extent their things are changing, but I think that's kind of a good thing happening within the NEA.
Yeah, I can see it just turning into another council or committee that NEA loves to create,
right?
And get bogged down once a new president comes in.
So I think that those NEA locals are also worried about that, and also want to try to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. It sounds like they're still trying to bring up what Bob Chase started as the new union.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the other thing that has kind of blossomed out of the TURN network is the Institute for Teacher Union Leadership, which has since been renamed to the Tom Mooney Institute for Teacher Union Leadership, because after Tom's death, he was a part of the team that developed and taught in and was one of the leaders of the Institute for Teacher Union Leadership, one of the movers in that institute. And to honor him after his death and to continue the work in his name, we renamed it Mooney Institute for Teacher Union Leadership. It's our first activity was to have a two-year cycle of support for a group of half a dozen locals who were experiencing leadership change or who were anticipating leadership change, who had younger people who or people who weren't currently in leadership that they could bring, And we had for two summers, we had week-long institutes. The first one was here in Minneapolis at the University of Minnesota, and the second one was at Harvard. And those institutes, we talked about what we developed as the three frames of teacher union leadership, the industrial frame, the professional frame, and the social justice frame. And it doesn't mean that they are separate. It means, you know, teacher union leadership is a whole thing. But it just means that there are aspects to teacher union leadership that at one time or another, fit into those categories. And those locals, then we followed up with visits to their locals in their cities. We did reports on what we saw and what we experienced, had discussions with their teams as to where they wanted to go with the information and some plans that they, so they would develop some plans for the future for leadership and for their locals. And so we kept in touch with those locals at the day prior to TURN meetings, because they were all TURN locals, and then separately. So we're at another point now where we're trying to decide whether to start the next two-year cycle for some more locals, and also whether to start to have a national conference or national seminar, national get-together to talk about what's happening in public education right now and how to save it.
That would be a different shift,
yeah,
but needed.
Right, because it doesn't seem to be happening any place where you can get a sort of a, I don't know whether you'd say a balanced discussion. There are plenty of conferences supported by the folks who are trying to do us in.
Oh, yeah.
And but they're... When you get, for instance, to, then there will be Quest Conference this summer in the AFT. That'll be primarily instructional in nature. And the NEA convention is the last place in the world to have that discussion. So we do think it's needed. So I think our next challenge now is to see whether we can find enough sponsors and supporters to pull it off.
All right. Would this be focused on issues of public education leadership, or would be encompass the whole issues?
Well, leadership certainly would have a huge part of it.
Yeah.
But I think it probably would be broader than that.
Okay. And you mentioned social justice unionism.
Mm-hmm.
I know it was dear to Tom, as well as everybody probably in TURN, but...
Particularly Tom.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by social justice? Is a community level with United Way and food banking, or on a larger international scale?
Well, of course, for Tom, it was all of the above.
Yeah.
But and then some.
How about you, though?
Well, social justice unionism, I think, in my mind, mostly goes to the point that in our TURN documents, our TURN goals, our TURN standards, and our TURN mission statement, we have in there that it is as much the responsibility of teacher unions and teacher union leaders to be concerned about whether students learn or not than it is to take care of our own members' needs. And that's where it kind of all comes together for me, is the... and Shanker was quoted with roughly that quote some years ago. And I believe pretty strongly that as a... as a union and as a union leader, we have a dual role. One is to make sure that the teachers that who are members of ours are highly skilled, highly trained, highly supported, and successful, and surrounded with the supports that will make them help them be successful. But at the same time, we have to look really clearly, and sometimes with a really white hot spotlight, at what's happening to kids in our classrooms. And we can't assume that because teachers are skilled and happy and well paid and supported, that it necessarily is that the students in those classrooms are learning all that they can learn. So if you take on that dual responsibility, you need to have the cooperation and the ear and the collaboration of folks in the community. And I think to some extent, I've learned the most about social justice unionism from some of the other unions. For instance, hotel restaurant employees. Mm-hmm. They do a great job of involving the faith community and the other the ethnic communities, because so many of their members are members of ethnic communities and recent immigrants. SEIU has a really good record in this town of involving, again, the faith community, the community leaders, not just politicians, but all kinds of other community leaders. And when you're on a, for instance, on a picket line in front of a hotel in this town, when the hotel restaurant employees go out, which isn't very often, but I can remember in front of a biggest hotel in town that we drove by today, there was a picket line out there when they first opened up because they didn't sign an agreement right away. It looked like the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And there were Somalis in, you know, full garb. And there were Hmong women, and there were Hispanic males, and there were, you know, every part of the world that you can imagine, and all banging on pots and pans. And then there were, you know, those of us who were traditional holdovers, German Scandinavians from around here.
Yeah.
And it was just fascinating. So we were chanting and walking around and picketing, I just marveled. And then there were ministers there, and there were politicians there, and there were people from agencies there, and it was pretty inspiring. Mm-hmm. They were successful, of course, because mm-hmm. you need everybody. We've been successful in this town in having
living wage?
Living wage campaign, thank you. And that was because that we had the support of everybody. Mm-hmm. It is the thing that I think has been most difficult for me as a leader. I was always able to operate really well with a lot of the leaders, a lot of the communities. But what we didn't handle well in the Minneapolis schools were the negative, and we have more than our share, the negative leaders, primarily the African-American leaders in the community, who are always negative against the schools and always willing to blame the schools. And I always was jealous that Tom was really good at that, and I wasn't. Yeah. So, and really, I was able on a personal level to work with them, and but there was just a point at which the relationship didn't work. But social justice unionism is also being involved with the and advertising the letter carriers food drive,
right,
so that our members do that, and being on the United Way board, and now I've been on the United Way board so many years, they finally passed a new policy that's going to kick me off, because they don't want anybody on there who's been on more than 15 years, and which is probably all right.
Yeah.
Newer, younger people should come on, but you know, there's always a struggle between. It takes, and this is where I think it's an interesting struggle in the NEA locals versus the AFT locals. Because the NEA locals like to say, well, we get this new, fresh, young leadership all the time, every 4 years or at the most 6 years. And the AFT leaders say, yeah, but, you know, we're around long enough, so we develop relationships, long-term relationships with politicians, with business folks, with agency leaders, with, you know, ethnic leaders, with all these leaders in town, and those relationships aren't built in a day, and they aren't tested over time. So, or they have to be tested over time. And so I think somewhere in there, between, you know, 30-year AFT presidencies and 4-year NEA presidencies, there's probably some happy medium, but that's, of course, the other place where Tom Mooney was a master at all of that, in developing those relationships. And he, of course, had the international interest. I went on several international trips with Al Shanker, which were pretty fascinating, and then he sent me on a few trips on my own, or with other folks. I went with Secretary Treasurer Porter to England, where we did a seminar with the NASUWT. And Adam Urbanski and I went to Hong Kong to do a seminar one time with the Hong Kong Teachers Union. And that was before they were became a part of China again, and were worried about their leaders. I went to Germany with on my own one time, all by myself, doing some staff development, professional development with the German staff developers, who in Germany, they the teachers just have to know how to teach, and the staff developers or the professional developers are through the central centralized Department of Education, and they tell the teachers what to teach. So this was the group that was meeting in the Black Forest, and I was scared because I missed my contact, who was supposed to meet me at the airport, because I was hours late. I don't remember why anymore. Hours late coming out of Minneapolis. And so I missed the contact, and I was all by myself. Yeah. And I thought, okay, Louise, now what are you going to do? So I managed to get myself by train up to this little siding, as all it was, in a tiny little town in up in the Black Forest, and then had to find there. There was one cab in town, one taxi, and then anyway, long story short, I got there. But I did that. But the other time I was in Germany, I was there with Al, and the president of the GEW, the GEW German teachers union, was a very imposing, tall German who stood very straight and erect, and he had this gigantic umbrella. And I'll never forget the fact that we went on, after we had had the meetings, we went on a tour of all of the castles on the Rhine. And after a while, I really did believe that statement that, you know, you've seen one castle, you've seen them all.
Yeah.
But, oh no, he was out there in front with his umbrella, you know, pointed straight out all the intricacies of all of the castles. And, of course, Al was eating it up.
Yeah.
And loved every minute of it. And I was kind of dragging back thinking, okay.
Was this the trip where you visited the school?
Yeah.
Oh, I forget the name of the school now.
Gesamtschulen.
Yes.
And Anna Ratzke's school.
Yeah.
And not only did we visit, I think I visited Anna Ratzke's school maybe twice. And we had Anna Ratzke come here a couple of times to visit, because we believe, you know, we have open schools in Minneapolis, which is very much like the Gesamtschulen, except the open school doesn't go in one place between grades 5 to 10, as hers did. And having the teacher's team and stay with those teams forever, she said it's tricky because teachers really do have lifetime tenure there. And if you get somebody on your team that doesn't pull their weight, they aren't going to pull their weight for the rest of your career. So she said, "You better figure out how to help them pull their, you know, yeah. Be a part of the team and pull their weight." But yes, she was. It was fascinating to visit her school, to have her come here, and it was really helpful in our discussions about where we wanted to go at that time, about teaming, about the issues of site-based management,
right.
The issues of a principal who viewed herself as part of the team.
'Cause they teach as well.
Yeah, they do teach as well, and it was very good. Very good. We still try to do shared leadership at the work site and site-based management, but it's gasping at best.
It just lost its juice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Needs another shot of something.
Right.
So what other international did you do?
Canada.
Yeah.
I went to Edmonton to see the site-based management there and the site-based budgeting. It was kind of fun because I went there with the governor, Tim Pawlenty, again. Uh-huh. And we were the guests of the Germazian brothers, who, you know, built the Mall of America.
Oh, right.
In Minneapolis. So they built the Edmonton Mall first, and then they built the Mall of America. And they wanted the governor's support for some additional roads and financial support out of the legislature for this huge expansion that they're planning. Really big expansion of the Mall of America.
Oh dear!
So they had a pretty fancy dinner that I was glad to be along and be a part of. And the Germazian brothers are pretty fascinating.
I bet.
Fascinating crowd.
I bet.
But the Edmonton model of site-based budgeting is interesting, also, and one that a lot of people tout. I think that one thing that we have thought a lot about and actually chickened out of, and I maybe in retrospect I shouldn't have, is that when Julia Kopic and Kirshner came out with their book called United Mind Workers.
Yep.
I thought at that time that we were a together enough local so that, and in control of enough of the teaching profession that we could think about being the supplier of the teachers for the district. And the district actually offered me to be the supplier of the substitute teachers as a start. So now, the reason I said no at the time is that you couldn't find a substitute teacher with a search party.
Right.
Because there was a shortage at that time. So I thought, well, how are we going to be successful at this any more than the district is? But in retrospect, I think it would have been a good in, and it would have been a good way to try it out to see whether we could be the guarantors of a good professional teachers for the system.
It's kind of like working halls.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a return to the guild. Mm-hmm. And the trades of training and inducting and providing workers for the workplace. So the hiring hall is exactly what it is. And I'm still enamored of that. I think, it's the time may have come and gone, but maybe not. Maybe the situation will arise again. Also, I've always been enamored recently enamored of Chuck Kirshner's first books, which had in it some choices for the work of teaching, what model we ought to be following. And after we'd spent the past 20 years on the professional model, then he reminded us the other day in a rather interesting conversation that was sponsored by one of the groups that brought together about a dozen people, both the right wingers and I think there were four or five of us AFT union goons in the room. And Chuck Kirshner started out the discussion by saying, we're at kind of a crossroads here because we still have these options for teaching. One is the true profession, which we've been working on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Another one is craft workers, mm-hmm. which would be the sort of the model if we went to the United Mind Workers hiring hall. We'd take care of all that, the training and so on. Another one is the a teacher as artist, which some people think that, teachers are born and not made, and that they are the iconoclasts who, don't fit well in a bureaucracy and so on. And then he said there are ensemble players, the ones who do deep listening and do well in cooperatives because they're willing to be an ensemble player and not a star. Mm-hmm. But then he said we still have the semblance of just being industrial workers. And what NCLB is doing, in my belief, is throwing us back to being industrial workers. And so we've spent 20 years trying to professionalize teaching, and now we're getting thrown back into the industrial model because it's top-down, it's organized around hierarchy, it's line supervisor oriented. You do the curriculum this way because that's the way, we've decided it's going to be better. And
the kids are on the assembly line, and the teachers are standing there just adding something as it goes along.
And right, programmed curriculum, and the everybody using the same textbook and all of that. And so our fear that brought back to into my head, or sort of gelled, why I'm so nervous about what's going on, under NCLB and the attacks from just about everywhere, instead of, because the right wing has now become very overt about their attacks on professionalizing teaching. They now say that we shouldn't be professionalizing.